Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to best-selling author and Georgetown professor Cal Newport, the man behind the wildly popular books So Good They Can't Ignore You, Deep Work, and his brand new title, Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. Originally from Houston, Texas, at the age of seven, Cal's dad got a job in New Jersey, so the family picked up and moved to the East Coast, where he spent the remainder of his childhood becoming a self-described computer nerd. Cal spent many years learning how to write code, tinker with computer hardware, and eventually went on to study computer science at Dartmouth and then get his PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It was in school that Cal started seriously writing and beginning to publish his work, both on his blog and in his first books about developing study habits and becoming a better student. Soon, he'd be working on his first bestseller, So Good They Can't Ignore You. In this episode, Cal and I talk about how he decided which topics to begin writing about from amongst his many interests and how much of an impact his day job as a professor has had on the success of his writing career. We dive into the immense importance of giving yourself large chunks of uninterrupted time for doing focused work and how he structured his best-selling book, Deep Work, around the systems and structures he built for himself. We explore his brand new book, Digital Minimalism, that talks about the negative side effects of integrating new technologies into our lives and what you can do about it to regain control of what's important. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Cal Newport. Cal, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ryan. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, the pleasure is all mine, and I gotta say, it's an honor to be speaking with you here today. I've been a reader of your books for many years, and for some quick context for our listeners here today, Cal is the best-selling author of six books, including So Good They Can't Ignore You, Deep Work, and his brand new book, which we're talking mostly about here today, Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. Now, before we get into all of the different projects you've taken on, Cal, I'd like to rewind the clock a little bit. Where are you originally from?
Well, if we go all the way back, Houston, Texas.
Whoa. All right. Is that where you grew up?
Yeah, so I was there for a while. And then at the age of seven, I moved to New Jersey outside Princeton. And that's where I spent the rest of my time before heading off to college.
And what was the move to Princeton area driven by?
Well, my dad got a new job in Princeton, and we got to see snow for the first time. So that kind of worked out well for everyone involved.
I like that. So, you know, you alluded to going off to school, right? So at what point did you kind of like personally develop an interest in computer science, which is what you've studied?
Well, I was a computer nerd pretty early on. So I was one of those kids of the 80s and early 90s who was programming their 286 IBM clones and learning different languages and figuring out how to access the graphic card, that type of work. So I'd always liked computers. So computer science made sense. I figured, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to study computer science. I got to college. Like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do computer science. I remember early on thinking, I know I've done some writing. Writing's really hard. So what I definitely am not going to get involved in is anything to have to do with writing. And so that was definitely a bit of self-discipline that failed pretty quickly. But I do have that clear memory of getting to college and saying, no, I'm doing computer science. I know I've done some writing before. That's way too hard. I definitely don't want to do that. And so I got that one pretty wrong.
Well, it seems like you've kind of struck a cool balance between writing in more of your personal time. And then, I mean, today you're still on the faculty at Georgetown University where you teach computer science. So you found some balance somewhere there.
Yeah, well, so now it's starting to make more sense. I mean, basically, my writing career has always been, I want to write about something that's relevant to me right now. So if you go all the way back, like my first books were for students, it was student advice books, but you know, I sold those books when I was still an undergraduate. And so that was really relevant to me. It's like, okay, I am a student, but I'm also interested in what do the best students do differently than other students. And so it made sense that I was writing about that. When I was writing So Good They Can't Ignore You, which is about careers and figuring out how to build a career that is going to be a source of passion, I was about to enter the job market. So again, it was like, okay, this is relevant to me. Let me write about what I'm doing in my life. And the deep work came out of when I was now a professor on the tenure track. It's like, okay, it demanding knowledge work jobs, how do you do good stuff? How do you actually make a difference? How do you be an impact? And that's where deep work came out of. And somewhere around there, I made this transition. So I became a tenured professor. I got comfortable with this idea that, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm a technologist. I'm a computer scientist. I'm an academic. It works on technology. That's where I decided, you know, I think where my writing could be most interesting and most relevant to my life is if, like I did in deep work and like I do in digital minimalism and like I do in the new books I'm working on now, I should really focus on the impact of these type of technologies I study as a professor on our culture. That it makes sense for someone who studies technology for a living to be one of the people who also does some self-reflection and actually does some public-facing writing about, hey, what's the impact of these things on work? What's the impact of these things on our personal life? What should we do about this? What do we already know about this? What can we learn from history? And so that's the groove I've fallen into now, is I'm pretty comfortable thinking of myself as a computer scientist, technologist, who also writes about the impact of these technologies on our culture.
I love that. And it seems like, you know, just kind of an observation as a reader of yours for so long, I feel like you probably, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you probably process a lot of these thoughts better yourself through the act of writing them down.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no better way to understand something than to fight with it for a year on the battlefield of Microsoft Word.
So Cal, I really enjoyed your book, Deep Work. And, you know, as I was turning page after page, it kind of felt like you were really like validating, clarifying, providing kind of a system around this belief that I already held that, you know, large chunks of uninterrupted work rather is so crucial to producing great results, especially with something like my craft of writing. So I know your original motivation for this was kind of like driven internally. You know, were there any other reasons that you really had to get this book out of your head and onto the pages?
Well, so the book I had written before Deep Work was called So Good They Can't Ignore You. That came out in 2012. And the main idea of that book is, okay, if you really study people who love what they do, it's often not because they solve the matching problem. It's not because they figured out this is my one true passion and then use that to select their career or job. What really seems to happen in the vast majority of people who really love their work is that they got really good at something valuable. That's the currency with which you can make all these investments and make your working life into something just really good. So that book came out, I believed it, and people asked the natural follow-up question, let's say that's true, becoming really good at valuable things is the key to making your work life into something that's really great. How do I do that? Sort of a little missing coda, I guess. I mean, I talked a little bit about it, So Good They Can't Ignore You, but you know, how do you become so good you can't be ignored? And as I was doing more serious self-reflection on that, that's what led me to Deep Work. I kept seeing the same pattern come up again and again, is that undistracted concentration, so being good at using your brain to create value out of information, was really at the core of most of these knowledge work jobs. So in some sense, it was the book before that pushed me into writing that particular title.
I love that. So moving on to, you know, our topic of conversation here today, your new book, Digital Minimalism, the core premise seems to me that, you know, as a society, we've been too casual at integrating new technologies into our lives. And that's led to kind of a lot of negative, unforeseen in many ways, side effects. What are some of those negative side effects you've seen?
Well, the main thing that I've noticed in looking into this topic, and in particular, trying to understand this unease that seems to be growing that people have about technology, especially in their personal life, what I've realized is that it's really not about utility. So the problem is not that, hey, this particular app is terrible, or that when I use this app, it's worthless, or it's making my life terrible. That's not actually what's going on. Right? People aren't angry necessarily in most cases at the particular behaviors they're doing when they're looking at their screen. Their real issue is with how much time they're spending doing this. So it's much more about autonomy than it is usefulness. That what people have begun to notice in the last year or two is that they're using these things, looking at their screens, more than they know is useful, more than they know is healthy, to the exclusion of things that they know for a fact are more important to them. They're also starting to feel increasingly manipulated. Like their mood is really affected by these things scrolling on their screen, or even what they believe in or how they act is being pushed around by these algorithms and what they're meaning to show them. And so that's what I really realized, right? The issue is autonomy. People feel like I'm losing control over my life. The quality of my life is being diminished. It's not the microscopic view that right now at this moment, when I'm clicking like on Instagram, that's terrible, because it's not. It's the fact that you clicked like on Instagram 85 times in the last 3 hours. And during those last 3 hours, you were supposed to be hanging out with your sons, but you barely gave them any attention. That's the thing that's getting to people. Not the small scale. What is this? It's the large scale of what's the overall impact.
Yeah. And the awareness, the self-awareness doesn't seem to be as much of an issue either, right? Like it's pretty easy to look at your, especially with the new rollout on iPhones of screen time, right? It tells you exactly how much time you spend looking at your phone and even the breakdown. So you can see that, hey, I spent an hour on Instagram, 2 hours in an email. So the awareness isn't the problem, right? And that seems like kind of an overarching theme of your book too. So getting into that next logical question, digital decluttering is a major part of the book. So can you kind of just explain this process of like, once you've identified the problem, once you're kind of convinced that, yes, I need to scale back my screen time, what do you do next?
Right. So Tinkery doesn't work very well. So people have tried tips that we've all seen that same article, turn off notifications. we've read it 20 times, and yet that hasn't solved all of our problems. We've all tried to do a digital Shabbat. Like, well, what if I don't use my phone on Saturday? Doesn't solve the problem, not cure the unease. So there's this growing awareness, not just that we're using the devices too much, there's a growing awareness that intention and tips are not enough to actually solve the problem. We need something stronger, right? And so that's what digital minimalism is. And it's a philosophy that says, look, you need to start from scratch, clear all this clutter out of your digital personal life, and then rebuild that digital personal life from scratch, but this time do it really carefully. Like, have a really high standard for what am I going to allow back into my life? It's got to have a really good reason to be there. And then once you bring it in, you also have to put rules around it. How and when am I going to use it? So it's pretty similar to what we see in physical minimalism, right? If someone's house is really, really cluttered, you know that they're not going to solve their unease by just walking around and randomly, occasionally choosing something and saying, you know, I don't need this one old pair of jeans. I'm going to donate it. Like, well, that's great, but you're not going to solve the problem, right? If you're really, your house is really overloaded, you're probably going to have to do the Marie Kondo thing. You're probably going to have to take out every single pair of jeans, every single piece of clothing, and say, okay, which ones earned their way back in? It's the same thing when you move minimalism to your digital life. You got to declutter it all out and rebuild from scratch, except for this time, do it really carefully.
Yeah, I like that corollary too. My girlfriend and I have been watching a lot of the Marie Kondo lately.
And so if just everyone who read her book would read mine, I think that would be good. Is that possible?
I mean, they're directly connected. They're so similar. So from like the really like tactical granular level here, does that mean, you know, what you would recommend people to do is like put kind of a, you know, delete all non-essential apps today, you know, put them on pause? Like, how do you kind of like create those little changes, the behavior changes?
Yeah, it's a little tricky. So I've honed a process over the last couple of years that culminated last year, in which I ran 1,600 people through the process and really gave it the final kicking up the tires and figure out what works and what doesn't. And it is a little bit subtle, so I think it's a good question. The clutter process that I recommend, so kind of my secret sauce, is that you base it around a 30-day period. And what you do for those 30 days is you stop using any technology in your personal life that is optional. And so I define optional to mean if you stop using it for 30 days, nothing really bad will happen. You know, maybe there'll be some minor inconveniences, but nothing really bad would happen. Now, there's going to be some technologies, right, that are in your personal digital life that you really can't completely walk away from because it would cause trouble. So if your daughter, that's always my example, if your daughter uses text messages to tell you I'm ready to be picked up from sports practice, that's not an optional use of the technology. Right? She's going to be at that playing field all month if you stop using text messaging. So that'd be not optional. So for the non-optional technologies that you're still a little bit suspect about, what we recommend instead is that you put rules of uses around them that are pretty stringent for the 30-day period. So you essentially wall off the really specific things you need to do, like if you have to check Twitter once a day for your work or something like this, you really wall that off. And if need be, use tools like Freedom to block it at other times so that you're not tempted. And so you really are trying to take 30 days and get away as much as possible from the technologies that aren't crucial to your everyday functioning. Then during those 30 days, there's two things to do. One, you do the hard self-reflection to try to figure out, okay, what do I actually want to do with my time? what's actually important to me. If I had to narrow it down to like, these are the five or six things that really matter in creating a life well-lived, and this is what I want to put my energy on, what are those five or six things? You got to do that self-reflection. It's going to require a lot of walking, a lot of thinking, a lot of not having a screen to look at. I also recommend during this time that you start to get reacquainted with some of the old analog hobbies you used to really like. Get a taste back again for the different ways you could fill your time that's maybe more meaningful. And then finally, when the 30 days are over, you don't go back to everything. You act as if I've cleaned the slate, I've reset, and now you have this really high bar before anything is allowed to make itself its way back into your life. It has to make a claim that it is one of the best ways to use technology to aid one of these small number of things that you've said you really care about. And outside of that, you ignore everything else.
So how do you personally decide? Like, you know, when you're at the end of this 30-day period, I feel like a 30-day period is a pretty attainable goal for most people to do, to commit to, and really kind of do a good job striking through that period of time. So once you're on the outside of this 30 days, like, how do you personally decide, you know, which kinds of digital activities or apps should be held dearly moving forward or kicked to the curb, aside from, you know, just seeing that you get some joy out of it? Is it really that simple?
No, I have a higher bar, right? So once you've written down somewhere, these are the things, right? These are the five or six things that really matter to me. This is how I want to spend my time. Once you have that written down, when a new technology comes into your orbit, you're starting to think, hey, should I use this? Maybe you're thinking about bringing it back, or maybe it's a new thing that's just been released, it's getting popular. I think the bar needs to be, is this the best way to use technology to boost this thing that I really care about? It's not enough that it offers you some value. Everything offers some value. And the idea that if something offers you some value, you should put it in your life, that's called maximalism. And that's what got us into this trouble in the first place. So it's not enough that it offers you some value. You want to find the big wins. Like, okay, maybe Facebook would kind of help this. I really care about my friends and my community, and I could come up with some scenarios where Facebook helps me there. But is that really the best way to use technology? If I really want to connect deeply and be there for my friends and community, you might say, you know what, there's better ways to use technology and come up with some use that's an even bigger win. And so that's what I think you should be looking for. The best way to use technology for the things you really care about, and essentially your answers to those questions, that's it. That defines the technology that you use in your personal life. So almost certainly, you'll be looking at a screen a lot less than most people, but also almost certainly, you'll probably be getting a lot more value out of the technology you use than they do as well. So it's not a Luddite move. It's much more of like an optimization move.
Right. So that each thing that you do choose to use to spend time on, it serves kind of a direct specific purpose towards something else that's more meaningful to you.
Yeah. And then I also recommend the real minimalist always put a how and when rule about it as well, because some of these services are so large and offer you so many functions that, you know, once you let them into your life, it can really take over. So a true digital minimalist would never just say, I use Facebook for this purpose. They would say, here is how I use Facebook and when I use Facebook. So it's not on my phone. It's on my desktop. I use Newsfeed Eradicator, so I literally can't see anything in the feeds or see any likes coming back to me. I only check it on this old browser on my computer on Sunday nights to see what's going on in this Facebook group. I mean, they really get pretty cool and pretty stringent about how and when, and that goes a long way as well. And what you're really trying to do here is take the cost to benefit ratio and then just shift this thing to be decisively in your advantage.
I love that. I love the specificity around it too. So you mentioned a couple of tools actually. Newsfeed Eradicator, I assume that's kind of like a Facebook Chrome extension or something.
Yep.
Is that accurate?
Yep.
And then Freedom, an app that kind of like, for those of you who haven't tried it before, it like limits your time. You set parameters around how much time you can use certain apps or websites. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So Freedom allows you to do that. And what was nice about it is it could control all your devices. So you can click one button and it's on your phone, it's on your computer, it's on your tablet. Though I have to say, I heard reports today, so breaking news, that Apple and Freedom are kind of at war right now. So once Apple started adding its own usage features to the new iOS, they're starting to prevent any other app from having control, that same type of control. Like, I think Apple is now making a move to say, right, we want to be the ones in the usage control space and we don't want anyone else to be able to do that. So I don't know how this is going to shake out, but as we're recording this now, there could be some changes to the landscape. But that's the basic idea. I mean, any sort of tool that basically allows you to turn off access to certain sites, and that's just a great training tool so you don't have to worry about it. If you don't want to be using something between certain hours and you can block it during those hours, that just makes it's so much emotional energy that you don't have to waste on that.
I couldn't agree more. Are there any other tools that you kind of like work into your daily workflow to help block off the digital use?
Well, I mean, a couple of things I've noticed with Sirius Minimalist is one, they use their phones for a lot less and they use their computers for a lot more. So one of the basic rules a lot of minimalists use when figuring out the how and when question is, if someone makes money off of me touching this app, I don't want it on my phone. Mobile is really where a lot of the large platforms put a lot of their attention into trying to engineer these sort of compulsive or addictive experiences. And they neglect the browser-based experience a lot more because people, for the most part, don't use them. So clever digital minimalists say, great, let me get out of this battlefield over here where these huge companies are firing these really well-engineered attention shells at me. Let me go over here where they're not even looking. It's much, much easier to get value out of the platform. So you definitely see that a lot. And you definitely see a lot of plugins. So I kind of call the movement that really tries to hack these things the attention resistance in the book. So a lot of plugins, you can get them for YouTube as well to cut off the auto recommenders. So people who use YouTube a lot for like how-to tutorials, which is great, they'll use these plugins so there's no recommendations. All they see is the video they're looking at. And I've started to see a rise in people who are interested in some of these tethered phones or tethered dumb phones where you could tether a very simple phone to your smartphone. So if you need a phone for emergencies, you can still have this and it's still your same number, but you don't have any of the apps or distractions with you. And so there's a lot of these clever tools I'm noticing out there for these members of the attention resistance, as I call it, who are really figured out ways to get huge value out of these free things without having to give up a lot of their time and attention returned.
Man, I love that. Have your iPhone, but then tether a dummy phone to it. This is like level 1000 optimization here.
I know. For the geek in me, I love it. But and I say, well, why don't you just get rid of your iPhone? You know what the answer often is? Is I guess there's some athletic things on the iPhone, like running apps or whatever. That's often the answer. Like, well, I still need it because on my runs, it tracks where I go on the GPS. I'm like, all right, fair enough.
Yep. There are some useful features, like it or not. All right, well, Cal, I wanted to ask you a couple of my frequently asked questions, which I've designed to be intentionally short on my end, but your responses do not need to be equally so.
Careful what you wish for. I'll try.
What would be your number one piece of advice to those in our audience here today that want to become an author themselves? What should they be focusing on today?
So writing is a skill that you have to get better at. This is often deceptive because writing in spaces like where I am, like nonfiction, like advice nonfiction, is meant to come across very easily, like you're talking to someone, but it's actually really hard to do. So even when you're outside of the hard writing genres like literary fiction, it's a skill that you need to get better at. And the best way to practice is you have to write things for editing. So you have to find some way and some video where you're writing something where an editor might accept or reject it. And if they do accept it, they're going to really work with you to make it better. So at first, it might be a very small publication, maybe something online, but that's where you start to get the real resistance that grows the muscles. So the more time you spend writing something for an editor with the power to accept or reject, and then the power to improve what's accepted, that's like booster rockets on your writing skill. If you just sit writing on your own, if you just do national novel writing month, or just say I'm going to do 1,000 words a day, or just blog or something like this without getting that resistance, your skill's going to grow a lot slower.
I love it. That is great advice. All right. Well, Cal, this is my last question for you. What would you say is the best investment you've ever made in the context of growing your writing skills? And this can be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise.
That's a good question. Well, one thing we did recently, certainly not a small investment, we moved to a smaller town near where we used to live outside of Washington, D.C. that has two things that were really important from a writing perspective. One, it's an old 120-year-old house that has a cool old study where it has a fireplace in it. And I invested to have a library style table, like from a university built with where I'm sitting right now with library style lights with my bookshelves next to it. So I've essentially replicated inside my house the sort of old library study rooms in which I used to read and think as a college student. And then Wow. Two, this is an incredibly walkable town. Lots of sidewalks, really, because it was built in the 1800s, really long runs of sidewalks with no cross streets and 100-year-old trees giving great cover. And so I could walk and think. So it wasn't cheap to do these things, but it's been great from the perspective of finding a way to get more deep thinking in and more creative inspiration.
Yeah, I like that. Making sure that you're in the environment that supports what you want to do.
It makes a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all right, Cal, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening today where they can go to learn more about you, your new books, and everything else you're up to?
Sure. Well, as a committed digital minimalist, I don't have any social media accounts, but I do have a website, calduport.com, where I've been blogging for over a decade. So if you want to find out more about me or my books or spend more time looking at my random ideas that probably is healthy for you, calduport.com will get you what you need.
Beautiful. And we'll include a link to digital minimalism in the show notes as well. Cal, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.